Thanks, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. The previous talk, Robert, really was a perfect segue into some of what I'll be sharing with you today in terms of production efficiencies. We'll spend a little time talking about water use efficiency in these systems. And it is, I agree fully, it is a critical driver of decisions. What I think is going on in the landscape is a lot of hype, a lot of excitement. That's good, good for agriculture. But what's really limiting us is knowledge for good choices. And I think if you went to Friedman's talk last night, you got that sense. You know, we're sort of having a party about biomass. We're having a party. It's time to stop the party, set that stuff aside, and let's sit down, roll up our sleeves, and get to work and understand how these systems work, what's efficient, what's not. I'll point out some of the anomalies, some of the bizarre data that's floating out there in biomass production systems that completely unreasonable, and notions that we need to set aside so that we can move forward in a meaningful way to help the planet. A couple of years ago, Steve Fales and others authored a CAST report. Many of you, I suspect, have seen this, that talks about the convergence of agriculture and energy. You know, and one could easily throw food into this, okay? Clearly, we're going to need large-scale production of cellulosic materials. And they need to offer high efficiencies of use of radiation, water, and nitrogen. We'll talk about those three and other features. At the same time, the public is demanding simultaneous provision of food and improvement in the environment, greenhouse gas reductions, improved water quality, air quality, wildlife. You heard about diversity last night if you went to Friedman's talk. Serious things, a huge challenge. We had some good discussion today earlier about composition and how it feeds into or relates to conversion technologies. I won't talk on that today. I want to touch on the input side with some sunlight issues, things related to radiation, some water, and then specifically with fertilizers and nitrogen, because those are hot topics, hot buttons. And we're really interested in yield and radiation and end use efficiency, and then water use efficiency as major drivers of the system, and places where we really do need better knowledge. This is a table from Emily Heaton, a group at Iowa State a couple of years ago, and it's just a comparison of what a biomass idiotype might look like. And they looked at corn, coppice willow or poplar, or miscanthus, and they just put checks in boxes where they thought that particular system had a discrete advantage. And where there's no box, it didn't have an advantage. And so, clearly, if you're thinking about perennial being a good thing, the trees and the miscanthus are good, corn's out. You get down here, corn's got an advantage for water use efficiency, maybe miscanthus, although we'll talk about that. Equipment, utilizing existing equipment, corn has an advantage over some of these systems. But there's two things that come out of this table. One, perennials seem to have an advantage over annuals. You can see that there's very few checks here. And that the concerns that we're going to touch on today include the radiation use efficiency, water use efficiency, and fertilizer use efficiency. We're going to hit on these three red buttons, starting first with the radiation use efficiency. So let's talk about yield of, and we're going to mainly talk about row crops, sorghum, corn, and things of that nature, but we'll use as a comparison some of these perennials, because I'm absolutely convinced, contrary to many others, we've got people who are strong evangelists for a particular system, particular plant. The miscanthus group is particularly strong in one group. They really think that's the way to go, and maybe they're right in some ecosystems. But clearly, we're going to deploy a portfolio of materials. One shoe does not fit all. So we're looking at an array of plant materials. Here's corn over here, miscanthus, soybeans, lowly soybeans sitting over here, really struggling. C3, not very productive. And in this setting, this was taken about a month ago at Purdue. The biomass yield of the miscanthus, dry matter above ground yield, is about twice that of the corn. These are both C4 plants. One's a perennial, one's not. Why is that? Well, if you look at the photosynthetic rate, just look at this box. This is cut out of an article by Dolman and Steve Long at Illinois. The photosynthetic rates of miscanthus are, in fact, lower, substantially lower than maize. They're both C4s. That's a surprise. You'd think that if it's yielding twice as much that, in fact, it may have a photosynthetic advantage. It does not. It does not. And so these numbers are averaged over multiple years and multiple measurements within a year. This is surprising because keep in mind that 90 to 95% of the biomass of a plant is derived from photosynthesis, 5 to 10% from the soil. So that difference is noticeable. What is different between them, or what's not different also, is the way they use radiation. Here's cumulative radiation interception throughout the growing season for two different years, and how it drives biomass, and these are just linear functions. It's a no-brainer, folks. You need to intercept radiation if you're going to grow things. Absolutely. Now, the advantage that Miscanthus has is on here, and it's subtle. Okay? You notice that the corn stops right about here, and Miscanthus keeps growing. In both years, the reason that Miscanthus is higher yielding is that it intercepts radiation for a longer period of time, a greater amount of the growing season. That's the advantage of being a perennial. And now there's talk about having perennial corn. Well, this would be one advantage. And to look at it another way, if you just look at the green leaf area index here as a function of time, and these are the two different growing seasons of the year, you'll notice that Miscanthus has green leaf area early in the season, peaks out at a higher leaf area during the middle of the year, and then comes back down, and it has more green leaf area late in the year. In fact, you saw that in that photograph a few minutes ago. In both of these two production years, corn is planted, but it doesn't have much leaf area until sometime in late May, and then it increases, peaks, and comes back down, peaks at a lower level. So clearly, leaf area development is key to radiation interception, and if you want to manipulate radiation interception for corn and improve it, well, we've done some of that. We've done it by looking at early planting dates. We moved them back in Indiana. We're planting corn in March some years. It's risky. But certainly early planting is one way to intercept more radiation and be more Miscanthus-like. And, of course, genetically, we look at a stay green trait in intercepting radiation and photosynthesizing later in the growing season. Again, a trait that plant breeding has brought about to make corn more productive. However, this is a modern hybrid, and it still isn't on par with Miscanthus under these conditions. So radiation use efficiency, key to producing biomass. Let's jump down and look at N-use efficiency for a few minutes. This is an article out of Chris Somerville and colleagues from Science a couple months ago. And I just want to point out, and it's about biomass systems. And they touch on various species, corn, stover and grain production, about 10 metric tons per hectare per year. They look at some other systems. What I want to point out for this comparison is Miscanthus, somewhere between 15 and 40 metric tons per hectare per year. The corn is the best characterized system, and we know that the N requirement is going to be somewhere around 100 kilograms per hectare. The Miscanthus, we're producing 2 or 3 times, maybe 4 times more, 0 to 15 kilograms per hectare nitrogen. Folks, I think we're having a party. How do you do that? Now, these plants may, in fact, fix nitrogen associatively, like sugarcane. There's talk of that, and those things are being studied. But when we go to the field and do some comparative analysis of this, by the way, this is Dr. Bruder, collaborated on this project, and here's sorghum, here's Miscanthus, here's Spartina, and plot them. Just plot yield, total above ground dry matter yield, and total plant N uptake. And this is just a meta-analysis. This isn't our data. This is a lot of other people's data, including Beal and Long, who are on the Long is on the Somerville paper. Okay, the data all lands on pretty much the same line. Okay, here's some prairie with zero nitrogen, very low yields, very little nitrogen taken up. Move up here a little bit. Here's another study on tropical maize, a little bit higher yields, proportionally more N taken up. You can go up here and look at Spartina and Miscanthus data, okay, and some corn data right here from a study in Wisconsin that's been fertilized with nitrogen. It all pretty much lands on the same line. And actually, using your own data, you can see that it doesn't take 0 to 15 kilograms per hectare to produce Miscanthus. It's somewhere as much as 300 kilograms per hectare. Okay, so we need knowledge for the choice. Knowledge for the choice. All right. So what would an improved end-use efficient system look like? Well, we've got one on here. Higher NUE would mean moving this line down so that at any one rate of N, let's just say at 100 kilograms per hectare, instead of coming down and getting 7 metric tons, megagrams per hectare, we're going to get 15 or 18, okay? Pretty simple. What system is doing that? What system is below this initial line? It's this cluster of data right here. This is, again, the Wisconsin study where they didn't fertilize the maize with nitrogen. We know that if you don't put inputs into these plants, don't add nitrogen, the efficiency is, in fact, higher. Okay? And you can see it here. They're below the line. The question is, do we want to go back to not fertilizing nitrogen or corn with nitrogen? I don't think so. We've got 3 billion more people arriving on the planet in the next 20 or 30 years. That'd be an irresponsible choice. So, what can we do about it? This is an article by Moose and Bilo against Illinois. A nice article that summarizes end-use efficiency, and they're looking at different processes, N acquisition by the root, N assimilation by the root and the shoot, utilization in seeds and ears, and et cetera. I want to look at 2 different processes, primary N assimilation here, and then also transporters using breeding and genetics, ways of manipulating these processes to improve end-use efficiency. Let's go back in time to a study by Bob Hageman. Now, that dates me, I know. He was a physiologist working at Illinois, working with breeders, doing a great job. This is an 8-year study with maize, divergent selection for nitrate reductase activity. Picked it because it's important and it's easy to assay. You can use this in a breeding program. Okay? 8 years of effort, millions of dollars spent on this study. The clear outcome is that if you improve nitrate reductase activity, you'll assimilate more nitrate fertilizer and increase yield and N efficiency. They grew these plants after doing the selection in the field and looked at yield and looked at nitrogen uptake efficiency. Here's the original population that they selected from. You can see that they had a large range, 4-fold range in nitrate reductase activity, but as they increased it, they really didn't increase yield. They did not increase yield, okay? Not limited by nitrate reductase activity, but if you did decrease it, they did bidirectional selection, yield would go down. So they could decrease it from the original population, but they couldn't improve it. Whatever was in that original population was enough to get the job done. Same thing with N uptake efficiency, whether you fertilize with 112, 224, or 336 kilograms of N per hectare, by increasing nitrate reductase activity, you did not improve N uptake efficiency. Okay, so it isn't that simple. A single gene trait may not be a solution. N uptake, transporters, a lot of interest in these. It's good to understand these factors. But this is a very quick slide to go through, whether you're growing the plants at 1 millimolar, 1 millimolar nitrate, or 10, and whether they're the wild-type plants or have a transgene in it that's unregulated for N nitrate uptake, the nitrate assimilation and uptake is the same. This transgenic approach, at least in this study, did not work and isn't limiting end-use efficiency. One last study by Joe Lauer at Wisconsin. You know, the value of some of these studies is that these are era studies. Go back looking at corn from 100 years ago. The question out there floating around by many, or the assumption, is that the end-use efficiency of modern hybrids is better than those from 100 years ago. All right, so if we take and look at 1900, 1930, up to 1991 to 1998, okay, this is the last era window of time that he selected these plants and looked at them and grew them in a common environment, and looked at a plot between above-ground biomass and total N above-ground. If you start here somewhere in the mid-50s, as we improved from the 1950s to the 1998s, you know, the relationship pretty much lands on the same line. Slight departure, but really not much more efficient. Or if you go back in time and ask the question, were the ones in 1950 better than earlier produced from the 1900s? Not really. Yield was different. But the relationship between biomass and N is the same. And these two things are inextricably linked. Now, what you would expect, if the later materials were actually higher in end-use efficiency, this line would depart and come over here. We'd get more biomass and less N. And that's just not obvious. All right. Some plants have better end-use efficiency. Sorghum is probably one, and it's poorly understood. It's an opportunity. just look at the right panel, above ground dry matter yield, zero nitrogen. You're looking at three sorghum lines, here, here, and here, zero N. All of them are yielding much more than corn above ground. One of them, twice as much. That's this photoperiod-sensitive material back here behind. There's Dr. Brudere. She isn't 2 feet tall, as you might think. So it is incredibly productive, even under very low nitrogen levels compared to corn, which is right here. Corn needs to be fertilized in this study to about 134 kilograms per hectare, whereas the sorghums all maximize their dry matter above ground yield somewhere about half that. So better end use efficiency, and you can see it. Here's Sylvie standing, here's a corn plant, getting a set of corn plots, getting the same rate of N as the sorghum just on her, on your left. And certainly the sorghum looks much healthier than the maize. So there are differences, and differences that we just don't understand. Let me wrap up by talking now about what was discussed a few minutes ago about water and the role of water in these production systems. Incredibly important. It's almost a no-brainer that water and plant material, plant production is tied, inextricably linked. They really are. Here's the map of the vegetation patterns across the planet. Okay. Here's a map of our distribution of precipitation. And you can see that in areas where we get precipitation, here we get vegetation, even in these little agroecosystems that are fairly isolated. An area where we don't get any rain, it's the southern desert, very, very dry. The disconnect is out here in the east coast, eastern half of the U.S., where we get a lot of rain in certain areas, but down here, it's the soils that are limiting productivity. And the vegetation doesn't grow in that region because the soils are more limiting. So it's water and soils. So don't, you know, my soils, I know I'm in a soils division. Got to be kind of careful, don't I, Doug? It's not all about plants, but soils are important. Okay? And so I'll recognize that right off the bat. But what that does tell us is that we just can't assume that water's going to drive everything. Now, what does water do in plants? Some of these are obvious. It's a reactant. We talked about hydrolyzing things a few minutes ago to break down starch or sugars. That's great. It's a solvent for constituents. Everything floats in water inside of a plant cell. Okay, so it's a solvent. It defines plant shape via turgor pressure, but the big one is at the bottom. It's transpiration. 99% of the water a plant uses passes through it, and in doing so, cools it. And it's like Thomas Friedman said last night, there's a bit of this is just Mother Nature. This is biophysical. It's a latent heat of vaporization. As that water evaporates from the surface of those leaves, 540 kilocalories of energy are dissipated, and that plant stays cool. When they stop transpiring, temperatures go up within minutes, and that's usually bad. Okay? Usually bad. Here's an example that shows the model conductance and its relationship to photosynthesis. Remember, 90 to 95% of the plant dry weight is acquired through this process, and to have high photosynthesis, we've got to have high stomatal conductance. The stomates that need to be open, CO2 needs to come into the leaves. Okay? And if you look at an article by Tom Sinclair, you can see that, yield is very, very closely tied to water use, as was pointed out a few minutes ago. And real data for corn grown under different rates of N, different irrigation schemes, look something like this. This is just grain yield, but it does represent total biomass yield nicely as well. It would just be twice these values for total biomass, that as yield goes up, total evapotranspiration in millimeters increases accordingly. These things are linked. Okay. Now, water use in wheat follows the same pattern. This isn't something simply restricted to maize. You see as yield of wheat goes up, water use goes up. This is a study where they've got different rates of nitrogen, different varieties. And one point reason for showing you that data is that in order to optimize water use, you want to really manage everything else very well. In this case, we've got highest yields out here, with the highest rates of nitrogen, permit us to actually have a better water use efficiency. In this case, low numbers are good. Okay, so as this goes from low yields and not very efficient use of water to higher yields and better water use efficiency, is really driven by better management. So management has a role to play in water use efficiency, a very, very important one. So let's talk just briefly about water use efficiency, give you some examples. A value, it's expressed a lot of ways. We'll talk about today is pounds of water needed to produce a pound of dry matter. The values range from 250 to 1,500. We talked a few minutes ago about alfalfa. 1,500 is the value for alfalfa. You're getting alfalfa, or it takes a lot of water to get high yield of alfalfa. This is why. Think about it. You're talking almost a ton of water to produce 1 pound of dry matter. Enormous water requirements. Some of the C4 plants are in the 300 to 400, 500 range. Factors that stimulate yield, genetics, fertility, reduced pests, also tend to improve water use efficiencies. Now, if we're going to deploy biomass crops in a water-limited environment, what's the strategy? What do we need to know? Well, we need to know where the water is. We need to know how much of it comes during the growing season. It's about 60%, actually. For most of the upper Midwest, water use efficiency values we need to know, and then impact of management. We're not going to touch much on that today. So given those constraints, it's no surprise that corn production and ethanol facility follow the water and the soils. The corn production for the U.S. in 2008 is shown here with green dots, the green squares. The more green the area is, the more corn is produced, and the ethanol plants are little red specks shown scattered around on the map as well. So the water, the corn, and the ethanol plants all converge. The areas that are boxed off in red here are irrigated systems there and along the Mississippi River. Probably not sustainable. I'd be surprised if we're growing corn, irrigated corn, in those areas 100 or 200 years from now. And that may be sooner. It's just the water is running out and it's really expensive. So we know where the water is. We know where the soils are. Let's look at just a very simple example of where the water is here, and based on this water use efficiency value of this much water required to produce a pound of dry matter, knowing what the precipitation patterns are and that 60% of it comes in the growing season, that we could just crudely calculate that you get just under 15 megagrams per hectare in this area. And down here in the darker green region, just under 20. Actual values of trials run at the University of Illinois are very close, 13.5 up here in the north, just under 21 down here in this area of southern Illinois. So water is intimately connected with productivity of these biomass crops. Really is, okay? An article last year from Science, well, let me go back. Now, this was mentioned a few minutes ago, the tension between food and fuel. I guess I'd call it a myth that somehow we're going to deploy biomass out here in the western parts of the U.S., at least row crops. Now, certainly there are systems at work, part of our portfolio. I think switchgrass is a reasonable alternative, maybe some other warm season grasses. But growing corn out here under irrigated systems, or you go way out here where there's very little water, the productivity potential is incredibly low. Okay, so that really does mean that some of this, anyway, has to come back to the Midwest USA where we've got good soils and water. And it's incredibly important to think about this hard, because when you look at the cost of water, in this case it's liters of water per megawatt hour of energy generated. This is, again, an article by Service and Science from last year. It talks about values from various steps, coal and oil and nuclear, whatever. All of these numbers are, it seems like a lot of water anyway, but when you get down to corn ethanol under irrigated conditions and then soybean biodiesel, you're talking just under 30 million liters of water, folks. Are we going to pump that much water out there? I don't think so. Okay, so this is going to be rain-fed for at least some of these systems. Now, let me just close by going through a very simple calculation. And let's just assume that we're going to grow corn, something out there in the greater Midwest, or the Great Plains area, Utah. Let's go out someplace, western Nebraska, Utah, eastern Colorado, where it's really dry. If we go back to the DOE billion-ton report published a few years ago, we want to come up with a billion tons of dry matter. I'm going to convert this to pounds for you. I know this is a scientific meeting, but it follows your familiarity with these kinds of conversions and gets me to play with the Great Lakes. We're going to get back to these bodies of water in just a minute. If we take a water use efficiency of 500, which is a pretty good value for corn, very reasonable, we need 1 times 10 to the 15 pounds of water. And that converts to, with 8.3 pounds per gallon, to 1.2 times 10 to the 14 gallons of water. That's a lot of water, but how do you visualize that much water? Well, we look at there being a cubic kilometer of water contains this many gallons, okay? And so this really relates to 456 cubic kilometers of water. That's not very helpful either, is it? Cubic kilometers of a lot of water. But how do you really get your arms around it? Well, that amount of water is basically all of the water in Lake Erie, and actually part of Lake Ontario, but all of Lake Erie every year to grow the billion tons. So you drain that great lake every year to get this done, plus a little. So we probably would have about 10 years of Great Lakes water if this is going to be our strategy. We drain them. Bear in mind that they contain 84% of our fresh water, 21% of the world's fresh water. Probably not a great choice. Let me close with just a few points, maybe take-home messages. Light interception is critical to high yield. You saw that. One-to-one relationship, anything that you can do to improve light interception is likely to result in higher biomass yields of these systems. High yield requires nitrogen. It's that simple. Unless we fundamentally change the relationship of photosynthesis to yield and somehow do it without protein, it's going to take nitrogen. Increasing yield will increase water and N needs, and these will scale. I showed you repeatedly that these things are closely connected, and they scale together. N use efficiency in most row crop systems is low. Between 30 and 50% of the nitrogen we apply is recovered in the plants. A lot of it ends up in the water or the air, and that's an issue. The highest NUE you saw was associated with zero N application, but that also is the lowest yield. N losses to water and air can have serious environmental consequences, and we didn't get a chance to talk about those today, but Dr. Boudreau will talk about them on tomorrow afternoon. My last slide, biomass production requires an enormous amount of high-quality fresh water. Emphasis on enormous. Limited land is available for biomass production because we need adequate rainfall and good soils. And so there will be a tension, I think, between food and fuel. Genetics and irrigation management that increase yield will probably improve water use efficiency, but because they increase yield, they also increase total water use. Don't forget that. Efficiency is part of it. Total use is also very important. And that there's a critical need for knowledge. We need to compare these systems, understand what their efficiencies are, and what their total requirements are. So with that, I've got time for a question. I'll take one or two. Doug Carlin.
Jeff, you went over that one part on the Kansas and you just made so much of some thoughts it might be regulation, it might be, but that slide of showing only 10 to 15 programs in requirement.
0 to 15. Well, Doug, I don't know if I have the answers in the moment. That's the dearth of knowledge, what we don't know. And we need knowledge to make choices. And it's such a new cropping system, we just don't know. They're growing these plants. I'm guessing that some of this information, or at least the knowledge, is being extracted from studies in Illinois. Anybody who's driven through northern Illinois, those beautiful moss-soft soils, they might mineralize enough nitrogen to meet some or most of that crop's need. That plant also cycles nitrogen. Jen Burks, Jen, raise your hand. A student of ours is looking at N-cycling within the plant. You know, we've worked with alfalfa for many years and N-cycling within it. Again, large rhizomes on these plants. And so they may actually sequester in these rhizomes and recycle it for the initial spring growth. However, our initial estimates to calculations, it's about 60 pounds of N. It's about as good as we can do, using, again, some of Beal and Long's data, their own data. So we don't really know. Associative N2 fixation, I know that they have seen or isolated those organisms, but that's different than saying that they're functioning. And functioning at a rate that would give us 250, 300 pounds of N per acre per year. We see that with sugar cane, so it may not be surprising, but we just don't often see that in temperate systems. So, thank you.